Hello and welcome to episode 42 of the Wilder podcast. In this episode, Tom Johnston from We Are Nature Based introduces us to two restorative practices, natural flood management and nature guardianship. Good evening, Tom.
Hello. I feel like maybe I've forgotten how to podcast.
Sorry.
No, don't say sorry. I mean, we've got past the point of apologising about not getting this out. I think now our listeners are expecting it to be delayed, maybe, and also not only that, are supportive of the fact that maybe we've had a bit going on.
Let's hope so, because I was slightly embarrassed to see it's been over a month since our last episode was released.
What do you mean? You mean 2 weeks and a few days is what you're...
Yeah.
And weeks, maybe. But okay, well, hey, look, maybe people listening for the first time, if you are new to the podcast, welcome. We really, really are happy to have you here. If you want to find out more about the podcast writ large, then feel free to go to previous episodes where we normally give an introduction about who we are and what we do. But this week, as it is a special episode, because of something awesome that happened over the last weekend, we want to give the airtime to the fact that the Grange Hub, the thing that we've been working for the last 2 years, as, along with everything else, has been officially opened. And we had a bit of a boogie. Can we say that? Am I not? That's probably awkward.
No, I think we could. I think there was definitely boogieing that happened in varying forms. And I think it's really right to start with that 2 year point, because I mean, I wonder if it even goes beyond that. When we first walked around this land 3 years ago, before we purchased Grange Farm, we saw those barns and we thought, that's an opportunity. That's an opportunity to bring people here, to bring people together. There's our infrastructure that will make all this possible. And I think it has delivered on that.
Yeah. And I mean, we can talk about the opening probably a little bit later on, but just to keep talking about that, I mean, it was not a foregone conclusion. It was a lot of hoops to go through. You know, there's no guarantee you can get planning permission for a building, essentially, to convert an agricultural barn into the Grange Hub, which is what we've done, which has beautiful bifold views over the whole of the Grange project. It feels like you're being hugged by nature when you're in there. It's a real purpose-built building to get people closer to nature, get them connected to nature, but also be a functional building to run all the amazing courses, hopefully, and corporate away days, team away days, community days, and things that we can add to the community by.
I think my favourite description of it so far is it's like a clubhouse, that relaxed vibe where people can come together, but it also has a kind of special feel. People come and they say, it feels like we're on holiday. And that is really nice when we have those reflections.
Well, it wasn't that. It was a holiday, but it was actually safari. And that is true in lots of ways. You're sat on the decking, looking out just over the land, and occasionally this is the pigs will snuffle by and you get to see kestrels hunting and the house martins and swifts and butterflies. It is wonderful. Although, on that note, bit of a tangent here, and I acknowledge it before you give me the eyes.
I mean, it is our podcast, so you can go on a tangent if you wish.
Being surrounded by nature and having this beautiful building comes with its unintended consequences, as you'd expect, but not this one. We have these bifold doors now, and every morning we come down and there was copious amounts of bird poo around the edge of the base of where all the bifold doors were. And there's no good reason for it. There's no particular lip or perch area. And then we noticed the glass was getting smudged and kind of dirty, which is not ideal when you've got an opening ceremony to do, but I digress. And we couldn't work out what it was, could we?
Nope.
There was lots of theories and we couldn't work out what it was. It turns out, after working in the Grange Hub for a day, I came down and I saw this crow had now, I believe, kind of fallen in love with its own reflection. Thinks it's found a mate, and now spends hours staring at itself and pecking and flying at itself and pooping.
It is impressive how much one bird has pooped.
Yeah. If anyone has any recommendations as to how to say it's not you, it's me, or whatever we need to say.
How do we break up with a crow?
No, because I tried running towards it and it was there and I accidentally scared it, so it kind of like flapped around and eventually ran away. Now, I don't know if that's worked. If anyone can give me a better idea, I can't explain, and I don't want to take a picture of it because it's really unpleasant, but I can't explain how unpleasant that crow is.
And a bird scare wouldn't really be with the vibe of the project.
No, but equally, we can't have a self-obsessed crow, needy crow on the project either. So I don't know. We'll work it out. Any advice, please? Hello at grangeproject.co.uk.
But there are some positive consequences of our natural location. I was teaching...
I hope so.
Well, of the many positive consequences, I was teaching a workshop the other day and literally a flock of house martins flew in one bifold, cruised around the building and flew out the other bifold.
A flock?
Yeah. I mean, okay, three or four.
I don't know how many birds make a flock, but is that a philosophical question? I'm not sure. But either way, okay, so they flew in. And what did your participants think of it?
unfortunately, I was in the privileged position of facing the way they were flying. So before I had a chance to introduce the fact they'd come in and out, they'd already gone. So probably no one believed me.
That's cool. But we are digressing, and I do want to make sure we cover the opening. Chloe, would you like to explain the concept of the opening and who we got there and how it went?
Sure. Well, there is no doubt that we would not have got to where we've got to without our community behind us. And we really wanted to celebrate the input of all people, whether it's been friends and family that have supported us on the journey, community members that have given us their time and energy, or people that have partnered and working alongside the project. We wanted them all to be there to help us to celebrate this real milestone of the project.
And who would you get to open it?
On the back of interviewing Jane Davidson, who eloquently described the Wellbeing Future Generations Act, which is this amazing piece of legislation in Wales that means all public decision-making has to take into account the impact of any decision on seven generations' time. And we'll put a link to that episode in the show notes. We thought, wouldn't it be amazing to have a representative from that, the Act, or from people making decisions around that to come and open the hub? Because we could really feel like there was lots of resonance between the intentions of the Grange Project and the Wellbeing Act. So we sent off a speculative email to the Office of the Future Generations Commissioner and were absolutely delighted when Derek Walker himself accepted our invitation to come and open the hub.
Who is the current incumbent Future Generations Commissioner. And not only that, he turned up, we had a good walk around the project. He is a super nice guy. And from the conversations with him, it just felt like he was in a position that it's a hard position to be in because he's there to hold people accountable, but he's also got to bring people along the journey. And he just really got what we were trying to do. He gave a very nice speech. In fact, so nice, I'm going to take a clip of it and add it in right now. Here he is.
What this project is so well exemplified in the approach that this requires is it's about sustainable development. So it's not thinking in silos, just about the economy or just about health or just about nature even. It's about how, when we do things, we do it in a joined up way so it supports all of those goals. We call them our well-being goals. And I think what you've done here is just such a brilliant example of how you're trying to support the local economy, you're restoring nature, you're thinking about food production so we're more resilient to shocks from trade and war and all sorts of things. And this just sums up what the Future Generations Act is all about. So, huge well done to you and everyone that's been involved in this project. And now the bit that I don't want to miss. One, two, three.
I'm not going to lie, I was blushing a little bit when he was talking about that. But it was very nice that he had said such kind words. And like you say, having friends and family to hear that and to witness it, and obviously members of the community have enabled this to happen, was really special.
And it was particularly lovely. My lovely mum had made this beautiful wildflower ribbon that I don't think we gave her enough credit for on the day.
No.
But it was absolutely stunning. And it was just so nice to see Derek cutting that slightly untraditional, what do you call it, like barrier?
Metaphorical barrier. Right.
As opposed to the kind of red plastic ribbon. It felt really symbolic of what we were trying to achieve with the project.
And then we just had a few drinks, the community was bringing shares, the community brought lots of food,
went above and beyond themselves. The catering was incredible.
And then a very nice Kaylee band. If anyone ever wants a Kaylee band, we will put links to them in the show notes. They were fantastic.
Yeah, the Shipsters really got everyone going.
And people were partying. You know, again, not too late because, again, respectful of our neighbours. It went on until 10, but then people just stopped partying and just had a few, sat down outside on a decking and we were still out there at 1 o'clock in the morning chatting about everything and anything. And it was just, couldn't have asked for a better night.
Yeah, one of the advantages of it being pretty much the hottest day of the year meant the evening was pleasantly balmy. But yeah, there were a few minutes during the day where I was concerned we were going to cook everybody. But the wonderful thing about the Grange Hub is it has this amazing covered decking area. So even when it was at its hottest, you could still be in the shade.
Yeah. Right, just before we go into our conversation today, because it is a great one with Tom, and again, Tom's been a great friend of the project and has so much knowledge to share, I also wanted to acknowledge that it didn't go all to plan. I had to give my speech, and we didn't have a lot of time to prepare it. So I kind of wrote it down on the back of a piece of paper in between looking after the kids. And I got about halfway through, and this is I'm bringing this up. You're thinking, Chloe, I don't know why you are, but I just...
I think you're looking for a bit of therapy here, Tom, in terms of what you're about to share with us.
It's not in my nature to go halfway through a speech and then to start tearing up. And that's what happened. And I don't know whether it was the heat, it was the occasion, it was the fact our friends and family there, it was the fact that just this stuff going on with our animals we've got or whatever it was, but it was a combination of lots of things. And I got almost to the end and needed some moral support, which was massively embarrassing.
I actually think it's a really great thing to model that, you know, I think people sometimes assume that with the project as it is and with such an amazing facility that somehow we kind of hold all together all the time and we're like superheroes. But actually, I think it's really helpful to show that there are cracks in every part of the project that we patch up together with a lot of support and a lot of, you know, late nights and a lot of supporting each other. I just wanted to say how much I've appreciated you in this journey to get us to this point. We absolutely would not be here without your creative energy and all that you bring. And I think it's only right that at times we kind of show some of that vulnerability.
Yeah. Not going to happen next time though. So firstly, that was very nice, Chloe. Thank you for saying that. But definitely, I've written this thing in blood now that the next speech is going to be a corker that I actually get to the end of. But anyway, that moving on from that, I think I can now exercise that demon. Bit of a longer top than usual, but hopefully people appreciate this is not every day you open the cornerstone of the project, really, and really get the ball rolling. And if you've been listening and you're now inspired to get out here, of course, as always, this season is the first season for the cabins. We've had some really positive reviews from people staying. I think we're going to put some stuff on social media about some of the quotes and reviews that people have written. But generally speaking, it's a very relaxing place to be, and it's a great opportunity to reconnect with nature and think about what's actually important in life.
And on that note, we do have a discount code for any of our podcast community that fancies coming to stay in a cabin and chill out in the Grange Hub, whether that's having a drink from the Honesty Bar, playing a game of backgammon, or flirting with a crow. These are all your options. So the discount code will be in the show notes, but essentially it's all capitals, community10 with no space, and you have to book via the website.
Right. Tom has been very patient in every way. He's a man with an amazing background, lots of experience, hugely passionate. He's been to the project numerous times. He's the person that introduced us to this concept of natural flood management, and he's been helping support that on the project going forward, as well as other think tanks and stuff that we've been involved in together.
Tom's a real innovator, and I think that comes across in the podcast.
So without further ado, let's get into it, and we can have a bit of reflection at the end of the interview. Tom, welcome to the Wilder Podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure to host you on site. It was yesterday, 2 days ago, but it was also wonderful that you've taken the time, especially as you told me, you just had one of your teeth out yesterday, which is the fact you've taken the time now to talk to us, I think, is phenomenal effort.
Well, I needed to get in before you had any more absolute A-listers onto the podcast and totally psyched me out of coming on. We've been talking about it for a while, so it's great to finally get to talk.
Well, I mean, after Chloe, who could we get on next? Let's be honest. So, I mean, today it's a tale of two halves. I really, really want to talk about natural flood management, NFM, because you were the man that introduced the Grange project to it. And not only that, was involved and pivotal in having it installed in our land, and installed as a grandiose statement. We can talk about what that actually means in a second. And then the second half is going to be about nature guardianship. And I genuinely not really sure what that is. So I'm actually looking forward to having that conversation and understanding a bit more about it. But before we get into the conversation, Tom, would you mind introducing yourself? Let us know who you are, how you've got to where you are now.
Thank you very much. Well, yeah, I'm Tom Johnston. I am the founder and director of a community interest company called We Are Nature Based. We're based in Wales, and we work on the two areas that we're going to talk about today. So nature-based solutions and the rights of nature, or nature governance, or nature guardianship. And how I've got to where I am today has been a bit of a winding journey to get here. But I was a child who was brought up in the 80s by vegetarian, activist-y, grassroots community engaged parents. So was one of the few kids in school who was vegetarian. And then as I came into my teenage years, I did all sorts of grassroots environmental activism and campaigning and community group type bits and pieces. And alongside that, I was a mountain biker and an outdoor climber, paddler. And I fell into being an outdoor instructor in my early 20s. So I spent 15 years leading people on wilderness expeditions and journeys and doing a lot of what we would now call as nature connection, a little bit of adventure therapy type stuff, but a lot of real deep immersion in nature, in the outdoors. And in 2010, I ended up almost by mistake working for the Prince's Trust and doing a load of youth development work. And that really shifted my worldview and my perception on things and the power of nature to help people get over troubled pasts and get over difficulty in life. And then during that period, I also met a woman who became my wife. Catherine and I met and got married. And in 2014, she was diagnosed with cancer. So in 2016, she passed away. I was widowed, leaving her 15-year-old daughter and I to figure out what next. And for me, part of what next ended up being a bit of an adventure tour of the world, going and ticking off a load of those trips that I'd always said I was going to do and never got round to. So I rode my bike solo across Iceland and had a complete mental breakdown in the middle of the islands, miles and miles from anywhere. And then a few months later, I went out to Canada and then to New Zealand. And whilst I was in New Zealand, I had a paragliding accident and broke my back. No. And so I came back not able to work to the same level that I'd been able to work to before, having both some physical and some mental demons to overcome. And it caused me to pause and really reassess what I was doing with my life. And I realized that whilst taking people out into the outdoors has got massive benefit, I felt like there was more I could be doing. So I went back to university and I got a master's in marine environmental protection. And I had every intention of spending the rest of my life sailing on the high seas and disentangling whales from fishing nets and, you know, all of that hero stuff. But reality then landed pretty hard. I graduated in the middle of COVID. There was no work. There was no way you could work, get outside of the UK and get on board ship or any of that sort of stuff. And completely by chance, I fell into a job with one of the protected landscapes in Northeast Wales and became their lead for green infrastructure, climate change and natural flood management. And I very quickly came to realize that I really got NFN. And I think it was all of those years of jumping into water and knowing what water feels like, what it can do, how it moves, and the physical impact on myself of poor water quality. There's nothing quite like going paddling for the afternoon and spending the whole night retching into the toilet bowl to make you value clean water. I worked for Protected Landscapes in Wales for a few years. And during that time, I met you guys. And really consolidated a lot of my thinking and learning around natural flood management and have got to a point of seeing it as a restorative practice. And that restorative practice in watercourses, then in the last couple of years, I met with the folks from Faith in Nature, Simeon and Anne, who were the first company in the world to put nature on the board, and got talking to them about nature governance, which again feels to me like a restorative practice. And hence, when I put the community interest company together last year, those were the two pieces of the puzzle that really struck me as areas with great potential in Wales, but not the resource and the capacity to move them forward as quickly as I thought needed moving forward. So hence those being our sort of two focuses at the moment.
What a life, what a journey maybe you've been on. And I know we've met a number of times, had the pleasure of having dinner together, and I didn't know half of any of that. So I feel like I'm already getting to know more depths to you than we had before. But with the natural flood management element, you know, it sounds like you've been on a journey going from what you got involved in it originally for to where you've ended up. So if you wouldn't mind starting off to someone have never heard the phrase or the acronym before, would you mind explaining in really basic terms what NFM is and what it would look like if they walked past it?
Yeah, for sure. So I think we have to rewind slightly further and just think that a lot of the way that we think about managing water is what would be referred to as grey infrastructure. So that's built environment stuff. It's dams, it's culverts, it's reservoirs, it's pouring concrete. And natural flood management is a very broad term that is looking at using natural processes or natural functions to manage flows of water instead. There's a huge spectrum of what could count as natural flood management, and some of those approaches are still massively engineered and incredibly expensive and can be huge scale. Not far from you guys, there's constructed wetlands in Herefordshire that are helping to purify water coming out of sewage treatment plants. Those would be, certainly they're a type of nature-based solution. Whether they're an NFM, you know, could be argued, but they're certainly a nature-based solution. And really where I found myself settling is it at the opposite end of the scale. So really looking at doing very, very small, unintrusive interventions that are as close to mimicking what nature would do if we hadn't messed about the watercourses anyway, but doing them in huge quantity. And so the majority of our work and my effort over the last few years has been doing what we refer to as leaky woody structures. And people will often call them leaky woody dams. I tend to avoid using the D word, but these are essentially sticks in streams and logs in the watercourse to slow the flow. And people will have heard that phrase, slow the flow. It's about adding surface roughness into the landscape and into the watercourses so that it takes water more time to travel through an area of land, and so there's more opportunities for it to get caught up and for it to pool and for it to slow down, for it to leave some of its debris behind, for some of the sediments and gravels that have been carried by it to deposit out. Some of these features are absolutely tiny. You know, some of the stuff that we've installed at yours is just over ankle height, and it's, you know, a couple of maybe 3 or 4 inch round older logs going across the watercourse. Some of the features that we install are much, much larger. You know, some of this stuff is chest sort of height and can take a crew a couple of days to build. But really, it's, if you think about a watercourse that has had no management over a really long period of time, there will be trees that have slid, slumped, fallen, dropped into that watercourse and will have caught some debris and tangled up some living and dead material, and then sediments and gravels will have started to accumulate behind them. It's those sorts of natural processes that we're looking at putting back in, but in that considered manner of going, let's not do it next to a culvert, let's not do it next to a footpath, let's not do it somewhere it could accidentally cause problems.
Could you just go back a little bit and explain what we've done to our watercourses, I think historically, and why that's happened? Because I think that'd be really useful for listeners and myself to kind of fully understand that. And then secondly, and I think it feeds into it anyway, why should I care? Why should I care about putting these in? What's the impact? What's a so what to people listening?
So for the last 100 or more years, there's been, very understandably so, there has been a mindset of getting water off the land. And for a good period of time, that was about improving the quality of the land. So making land less wet, less boggy, so that it was easier to turn livestock out onto, easier to work, easier to get some sort of production out of. And that was to feed the nation, you know, got us through the world wars. It has allowed us to plant massive blocks of forestry so that we have our own nation's supply of timber. And so there's been some very good, at the time, reasons behind trying to move water off land and improve areas of land. Part of that has also been about putting water where we want it rather than where it wants to be. And so lots of our watercourses are very straight. Lots of them will be canalized, so they'll have quite steep, straight banks. And in some areas of the country, you'll actually find that streams are running not at the lowest point in a valley, but they'll be flowing up on the shoulder of the valley somewhere, almost down a leat. But it's a leat that is 100 years old, and so everyone perceives it as being the stream. But when you look at the landscape, you realise that the low point is actually below it. You know, it's been done to improve land, turn wet, boggy, difficult to manage land into land that's more easy to manage. The downside of that is that it means that water moves off the land much quicker. And when we've then built towns and communities, typically around streams and rivers downstream, and when those communities have become full and we've needed to find extra space to build on, quite often that's ended up being on floodplains, on low-lying land around the watercourse. That combination of the two things, of moving water off the uplands very quickly and developing the nice flat fertile lands down below has meant that we've created this flood risk issue. When you then add in the third sort of spanner in the works, which is climate change, and climate change is changing the delivery of water. So in the UK, the Met Office predict that by 2080, there will only be around a 2% increase or decrease in the amount of rainfall that we receive annually. So effectively, the UK will be, on an annual basis, as wet as it is now. We're not going to notice any difference. But we're going to see double the number of flash flood events. And so that means that the same amount of water is going to arrive in much fewer, very, very severe downpours. And the number of droughts that we're going to see, those prolonged periods of no rainfall or very low fall, are going to become much more frequent. And so what you end up with is large areas of land that have no rainfall on them for 4, 6, 8, 10 weeks. The land gets very, very dry. It's like when you've left a sponge on the windowsill for too long. You put it back into the sink and it doesn't hold any water. You pull it back out, it's bone dry. You stick it in, pull it out, it's bone dry. It needs a little bit of moisture in there to sort of start it going. And then after that prolonged period of no rainfall, you have a sudden massive downpour event and the water just shoots straight off the land, straight into these canalized, straightened watercourses, shoots down then and lands in people's kitchens very, very quickly.
Yeah. Sorry to monopolize this conversation. I just feel like, Chloe, you're going to be asking loads of questions of the second half of this. But yeah, I mean, that was the thing that, drew the two reasons why we thought, well, you know, you offered to do some work on our land. We're like, well, is this rewilding? Should we do it? But actually, you know, the conversation Chloe and I had was, well, humans are also part of this ecosystem. And therefore, doing that actually will help prevent flooding for humans downstream. I think that's an important thing to talk about. I've also got an amazing time lapse, which I'll probably try and link in the show notes, of your leaky, woody debris in action. And it does work. It works very well. I was just wondering, because I looked at it, as the leaky woody debris was working, it was creating these backing up and like mini pools. Are there any additional benefits beyond the flood prevention that you've seen with these installations?
The first year that, or the first winter that I was being employed to work on NFM, I spent a lot of my time that winter going around farms, talking to farmers, trying to convince them to let me do this in their watercourses. And honestly, and completely fair enough, a lot of them looked at me like I had two heads. They were like, you're seriously going to come here and you want to spend good time and money putting sticks in streams like it's some magic solution? They were like, you're off your head. And I got very, very little buy-in. And then the following May, June was incredibly hot and dry. It was that one that we'll all remember. I don't know if it was 2021 or 2022. We had that really, really long dry spell, didn't we? And my phone started ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing. And it was farmers calling me up going, my streams run dry for the first time ever. I've never not had water for my livestock to go and drink. Do you want to come back and talk to me about this NFM, this leaky woody debris stuff again? You reckon you can hold some water on my land? Yeah, I'm interested. And it was in the summer that it really made a big difference to a lot of landowners. Since then, we've had a lot of landowners get in touch with us and go, I am just losing way too much land. And, you know, where those big flood events come through and they hit the corner of, you know, a bend in the stream or a bend in the river, and it just starts eroding a bank away. I've seen farmers lose 3 or 4 meters of a field in a single storm. Then they have another storm a month later and they lose another couple of meters. And then they're very, very quick to get on the phone. They're like, I can't afford to be losing 5, 10, 15, 20 meters of really good prime grazing land. What can we do to slow the flow down, to reduce some of the energy, to reduce some of the erosional impact? And so there's some real benefits on the site. There's a farm just up the road from us here in North Wales that has got very typical, very straight watercourses that run down the boundaries, you know, as we see across most of the country now. But at the bottom of these watercourses, it becomes culverted to get it under the main road. And they're seeing a lot of debris transport down. And that means a lot of gravel and some sticks building up at those culvert entrances every winter ends up blocking the culvert. And then the stream gets up and out of the watercourse and it runs across the field, strips topsoil off and takes all the topsoil off down the road. This particular farmer was having to go out at least twice a winter with a mini digger and dig out the culvert and just dig all, and he's got these massive great big gravel piles right next to where he's dug it out and dumped it, dug it out and dumped it. And so we've gone in and installed a load of NFM there, and that installation happened back in October, November. He's not had to take mini digger on once this winter. So it can have those real impacts there and then. Some of the downstream benefits, of course, the flooding, and also mitigating those low flow events. So it can help to slow the water running into the rivers in the summer and sort of keep that, whilst the level of the river will be low, it shouldn't drop quite as low because it's getting that slow, gentle top up over a longer period of time as that whole catchment continues to leak slowly in. Biodiversity benefits, wet woodland is an incredibly rare habitat now in the UK. And so by holding some of that water and nutrients up in the catchment, we can create really good little pockets of habitats and stop the nutrients from ending up down in the main river. If the nutrients are held up in the watercourse, then there's more opportunity for plants to lock them up and you get less of those algal blooms and all of the problems that we know are associated with nutrients in main rivers.
So everything you're saying, Tom, feels really logical and kind of really obvious, this idea of slowing the flow, bringing back biodiversity, mimicking natural processes, undoing some of the damage we might have done in our messing about with the watercourses, I think, as you described it. I'm wondering, how new is NFM as an idea, and at what sort of scale would we need to see it to have kind of a tangible impact for people on a daily basis?
I mean, if you look across the world, water has been managed through millennia by people. For a lot of that time, people have worked with natural processes. They've looked at the way that water behaves. They've looked at the way that ecosystems, plants and animals need water. And they've worked just with it a little bit more to get additional benefits for themselves out of it. It's really only the last 100, 150 years since the Industrial Revolution that we've really started to have massive impact on watercourses. And this is typically in the developed, the Western world, where we've had massive impacts on watercourses that we are now looking back on and going, oh, hang on, there was a whole load of unintended consequences from this that really scuppered us. You know, putting loads of weirs and dams into main rivers, blocking fish migration paths. You know, we now start to understand some of these problems. So I feel that this is a restorative practice. It's putting natural processes back into watercourses, and it's integrating in some of the modern technological thinking that we've got. In terms of water management, it's very cheap to do, but there are still costs associated with it. There's time and effort and costs associated with going out and doing this. And so if we can focus this into the areas of the catchment, either of greatest need or greatest opportunity, then you can get the best bang for your buck. But the approach that we take, as I said at the start, some of these features can be very, very small. So at that scale, one individual feature is not going to make any noticeable difference to you as a landowner or to a community downstream. But of course, if you do 100 interventions on your short stretch of watercourse and the farmer next to you does 100 on theirs and so on across the catchment, that cumulatively starts to add up to an awful lot. In the Upper Usk last winter, in a 6-week period, the folks who were installing for us down there put in about 700 leaky woody structures. And we reckon that that had the same flood storage capacity as adding an additional Brecon swimming pool into the catchment, so about 200,000 litres. Now, could you build a 200,000 litre storage tank or reservoir in the Upper Usk in a 6-week period without having massive impacts on the community or the person who owns the land, etc., etc.? No, you couldn't. And of course, you can do that tenfold. And these have very few negative unintended consequences and quite a number of potential positive consequences. And it's little bits that just sort of disappear into the upper headwaters of a catchment. And cumulatively, when you're putting in thousands or tens of thousands, then you start building up those real significant volumetric storage capacity to reduce major flood events, to continue to trickle water into those low flow events. If each of these holds back 400 or 500 litres of water, they might hold back 20, 30, 50 litres of sediment that plants can then capture nutrients from.
I'm listening to the conversation and trying to think about what critiques people might have of this approach. And I'm finding it hard, but there are two things coming to mind. One is the longevity of the installations. Once they're in, are we talking, how often do they need topping up? Do they need topping up? Do you put new ones in? And secondly, there's a mammal of the moment, which is the beaver, which everyone talks about as slowing the flow and creating these kind of fantastic
mammal of bug. The moment. Have you made that up? Because that's wonderful, Chloe.
I wrote that down. I don't think. Yeah. So I, you know, why would we use NFM and not just stick a beaver in a stream?
If this is done in the wrong place, then it can have some negative unintended consequences. You're not going to do this in a watercourse where you've got a land boundary running really close to the watercourse and your neighbour next door is trying to grow potatoes or has got an arable crop in there and you create a dam, you know, you accidentally shift the flow out of the watercourse across the middle of their field. It creates a new watercourse and it tears their arable crop in half. You're not going to do that. You're not going to do it if you've got a public right of way, a footpath running right down the side of it. You know, there's a number of such checks and balances that you identify through your screening process. We're not going to do it in or around scheduled ancient monuments, and it's probably not going to happen within SSSIs, sites of special scientific interest. There's also lots of protected species that use the waterways and riparian corridors. And so we need to put checks and balances in place to make sure that you're not affecting otter holts or, you know, white claw crayfish habitat. In terms of the longevity of these installations, obviously it depends on the species of lumber, of the tree species that you're using as the donor for the material and the size of the material that's going in. Some of the installations that we did at yours, there was a big diseased ash, and it was a huge diseased ash. You know, two people couldn't get their arms around it. When that came down, a big old chunk of that went in. Well, that's going to take 50, I don't know, 80, 100 years to rot down to the point where it can start drifting off downstream. And when it does start moving, it's going to be in tiny little fragments that have just rotted and come off the side of it. But there's another installation that we did at yours, which is all hazel and blackthorn and little whippy brash that's gone in. And of course, that will rot down much, much quicker. But what we typically find is that those brash bundle pile type installations that we do, they are so effective at capturing other debris that's washing down the watercourse, other leaves, other sticks, rocks, mud, and silts, that even as the original material starts to break down, there's almost this constant supply of new material going onto the back of it. So you get really good longevity. And I think the key thing about NFM for me is at some point, somebody, I don't know if they misquoted me, but it's got out there and it keeps coming back to haunt me that apparently I refer to NFM as being the gateway drug to better watercourse management. And I think what I meant by that is that it gives us an opportunity to go on to farm, go on to land, and to do something that has almost no chance of there being any negative consequence to the landowner. It's not going to cause them any problems. Crudely speaking, you know, they could be of a mindset of going, well, I don't care whether you do it or not. It's not going to have any benefit. It's not going to have any impact. And we certainly have installed on some farms where the farmers have gone, oh, yeah, well, do whatever you want. I don't care. We've done it. And then a year later, they come back and they go, can we have a chat about a bit more of this? Because it's slowing the debris transport. My culverts aren't getting blocked as quick, et cetera, a load of those benefits. But where I see it as having a real benefit and opportunity is we go in, we get it installed, and then we start having those conversations about, well, why don't you want to get the water off the land as quickly as possible? Well, why don't you want to canalize watercourses? Why don't you want to straighten them out? Why do you want to put the meanders back in again? And it's just starting to shift that thinking about water management to think more holistically and to undo some of that generational, you know, 100-year-long mindset that has caused some of the problems that we now face. So if you can do installations and start to change the attitude, Natural Resources Wales contracts and ordinary watercourse consent licenses, when they come out, will stipulate on them that at the end of a day's work, you must clear any debris from the watercourse. And of course, we're spending all day putting debris in the watercourse intentionally. You know, that shows how deeply ingrained this mindset is of keep the watercourses clear so that water continue to flow. And if we start to interrupt that thinking and go, hang on, in the right place, you want to slow that water down, you want to have the debris in there, then the next generation or this generation of land managers and the next generation are more likely to leave debris in the water course when they know it's not going to have any negative unintended consequences. And so, yes, some of the features we'll put in will rot out. But if you've changed the behaviour, then it doesn't matter that they've rotted out because nature will continue to top it up. It was a very long-winded answer to that one. Apologies. The beaver I can be a little bit more concise about. There's a couple of fundamental misunderstandings about Eurasian beaver ecology. And also, I don't think we've thought about the volume of the mammal of the moment that we might need. So if you were to release a bunch of beaver on your land right now, I would be willing to wager that pretty quickly they would bugger off downstream and find a nice deep bit of watercourse that was easy to live in, that they didn't have to dam, that had plenty of food supply along either bank. Because like us, most mammals won't live somewhere difficult if there's somewhere easy to live downstream. And beaver will then keep their one-year-old and their two-year-old kits in that family home. And they'll only push out the three-year-olds, effectively the teenagers. And the teenagers will get pushed out into the next best bit of habitat. So if we think about how much, from a beaver's point of view, good quality river habitat there is in the UK, well, we have very few beaver. We have an awful lot of river. So if we were to start releasing beaver into the countryside, they would all bugger off downstream to somewhere that they needed to build a lodge, but they didn't need to build any dams because the water was deep enough for them to survive without being predated upon by the wolves and the bears that they haven't realised aren't here yet. You would have to get to the point of having tens of thousands of beaver across Wales before they were being displaced, those teenagers were being displaced out into habitat where they had to dam in order to get the depth of water year round for them to be safe from the wolves and the bears that aren't here. Now, of course, if you put them in an enclosure, then you're forcing them to live in an area that they might not choose to live in, and then they will create those dams. And absolutely, when beaver do build dams, they do a much better job of it than we do. They do a fantastic job of capturing those sediments, those nutrients, mitigating the flows, managing the flows, creating incredible habitat. You get loads of other species coming in alongside them as well. But beaver releases aren't by themselves going to undo 100 odd years of poor watercourse management for us. We need NFM alongside.
As you were talking, Tom, it was making me think about where we started this conversation when you were talking about both NFM and the process of natural guardianship being a restorative practice. And I was thinking about the importance of people being involved in restoring some of the unintentional damage we've done to watercourses, and how NFM, I really like this point you're making about NFM both kind of being a practical solution, but also influencing cultural attitudes. And I think that feels really critical. And I was thinking about this idea of natural guardianship being a similar intention of influencing beliefs and attitudes. So I wonder whether you could say a little bit about what natural guardianship is and what kind of work you've been doing around within We Are Nature Based to that effect.
I think I'm slowly settling on the broad term of nature governance, but my sort of version of that is work that brings the voice of nature into decision-making structures. And so at the moment, the tool that we use most often for that is this idea of having a nature guardian, so a human representative speaking on behalf of nature in decision-making structures. And that tool borrows from the legal world, where if a child has to give evidence in a court of law, they will have an adult, a legal guardian, speak on their behalf. And so that's effectively what we're doing when we talk about nature guardianship. In June last year, We Are Nature Based were appointed to help the US Catchment Partnership develop their thinking and implementation of nature guardianship. And so we were appointed on a 24-month contract to have somebody sit on the US Catchment Partnership as a nature guardian and to help them gain experiential learning and thinking and help them with the recruitment of future nature guardians going forward. And so given my background, knowing a lot of the folks on the US Catchment Partnership, the decision was made that I would sit as that person, as that nature guardian. And really, it's a beautifully simplistic role to fulfill sitting in those meetings, because unlike almost everyone else who has to go in and sort of juggle between a couple of different hats, you know, they might have the hat of the profession that they do. Many of them are also farmers or also parents or other personal professional roles that will maybe switch in between. And then there's the personal and political relationships between the different people sat around the table. I'm able to go in and just wear that one hat of what would nature say. It's not always an easy role to fulfill, but we did a lot of work early doors, and I've built off the back of the relationships I already had so that everyone on the catchment partnership is very comfortable. And I think now with the questioning just being that, hang on, let's just pause and recenter for a minute. A lot of the time I find it's asking questions rather than offering statements. So I've never felt comfortable with the assumption that, or that sort of arrogant assumption that I might know what nature would think. You know, how could I possibly know what the river would think or what a particular species, you know, out in nature in the us catchment would think? But what I am able to do is mid-conversation or mid-decision-making process, stick my hand up and just go, hang on a minute, folks, can we just pause and reflect and ask, what would nature say to this? And it's allowed other people in the room, I think, an opportunity to pause and to bring thoughts and reflections into the agenda that they might not have otherwise had the professional capacity or that sense that they were able to bring forward. So it's been a really interesting process. There's Nature Guardians sitting in a number of other organisations as well. And one of the pieces of work that we're looking at doing at the moment as part of the UK Rights of Nature Network is to look at what a code of conduct or a code of ethics might be. So that as other organisations start to bring Nature Guardians in, we can all sort of sign up to a set of values or a set of practices. Because, of course, very quickly, people say, well, this nature governance stuff is all well and good, but what if, pick your evil multinational of choice, decided to do nature governance and nature guardianship and just recruited their own nature guardians from their own spheres and then put them in as a fantastic greenwashing exercise? And, you know, we saw a couple of years ago, Apple released an advert where Mother Nature came and sat in the boardroom and asked them a load of pointed questions. It was like, yeah, great advert. You did nothing else. They didn't even look at putting nature into the boardroom and ask some of those questions about, well, hang on a minute, what would nature say about mining that from there or shipping that from there to there or any of those other practices? So there's that side of it. And then the other side of it that quite often gets picked up is, well, yeah, but in somewhere like a catchment partnership or in somewhere like a rewilding project or a farm cluster, doesn't everybody love nature? And doesn't everybody think about nature? Well, yeah, of course we do. We all love nature and we all care for nature. But we've had 100-odd years of, I would say, most people loving and caring for nature. And it hasn't worked out all that brilliantly for nature on this little island of ours. We're perfectly comfortable with the idea of a corporate board or a decision-making board or committee having the HR director coming in to give that expert advice on HR or the finance director coming in. We had a conversation at one point about a particular piece of work that was going to need to be done and the cost and the time and the effort that was involved in it. And a cynic might say, well, you're going to put a whole load of effort into an Excel spreadsheet or a piece of paper that nobody's ever going to read. What's the point? Well, it's not that black and white. We know that despite what populism would like to have us think, there is a huge amount more nuance in most decisions that are being made. But what would nature say to that process? Well, nature would probably say, can we get that process done in the most concise way that it can be to do it justice? And then can we get onto the stuff that's actually going to have a positive impact for nature in the watercourse? And that, I think, can help reset us somewhat sometimes. I was asked to speak at the Archbishop of Wales's River Summit last year, and I went on immediately after a woman from NRW who'd been talking about consents and licenses and the need for that regulatory oversight. I don't disagree at all that there does need to be that regulatory oversight. But does nature think there needs to be regulatory oversight? Does nature care whether you've got a particular certificate or particular consent or not? No, nature cares about the outcome, about the actual action. Is the action, is whatever comes out of this, is it positive for nature or is it negative for nature?
And I can sort of imagine how having the voice of nature in somewhere like a river catchment decision-making forum would be comfortable within that context. But I'm thinking about more of a profit-making context, like a limited company. I know you mentioned faith in nature at the start of the conversation. So I suppose I wonder whether you have any examples of how nature guardianship has been present in an organisation that's oriented by shareholder return and profit making, and how do we know that this doesn't become, as you say, kind of greenwashing or tokenistic in its application?
The corporations out there who have put nature on the board so far, unsurprisingly, are those who are a bit more open-minded and pro-nature. Of course they are, because, you know, Rio Tinto aren't going to be the first company in the world to put nature on their board, are they? And so the impact, I don't think as yet, has been really that stark. But what has really struck us is the momentum of the idea. It really feels like an idea whose time has come. And it's gathering a lot of momentum. The work that we did with the US Catchment Partnership this year got picked up by Derek Walker, the Wellbeing of Future Generations Commissioner, and featured in their report this year as being one of the things in Wales that is helping Wales fulfil the 7 wellbeing goals. And when you go and talk to the folks at Faith in Nature or House of Hackney or any of the others, there don't seem to have been that many really blunt, really stark, oh, well, the nature guardian stopped us from doing this and changed direction radically. It seems to be more subtle and gentle nudges. I think one of the nudges that has probably occurred from the US Catchment Partnership, because I can only really draw on my own personal experience of doing this, but their core group meeting is happening next week. And for the first time in, I think it's 3-year history, there is going to be time taken out of that main core group meeting to go down to the river and to spend time on the bank of the river. And even in the invite to the core group meeting, it said, you know, this isn't an ideal spot to go swimming. We're not suggesting people get into the river, but you might like to at least take your shoes off and roll your trouser legs up and dip your feet in the water. And you think, this is a government-funded, effectively a nutrient management board. You know, this is a place that could be very shirt and tie and dry and key performance indicators and quite corporate in its way of thinking, even if it's not corporately profit-making. And yet it's taken the time to go out and to reconnect with nature. And to just pause and to go, let's remember why we're doing this. We're doing this because this river is dying. And if we don't make significant impact on it, then the species that rely on it and call it home aren't going to be able to continue to thrive.
Can I ask a stupid question?
Go for it.
What is the difference between an ESG, head of ESG, an organization, and a nature guardian or nature being on the board? What roles do they fulfill that are different or the same? And what conventional powers maybe do these two roles have?
Nature guardianship or nature governance or rights of nature can be done in many, many different ways. And I think that it's that simplicity of going, I only have to do one thing here. And, you know, generally you're appointed for a fixed term of a couple of years, and then somebody else will come in and take over and move on. Your pay isn't going to be linked to the profitability of the company. You're probably just dropping in to do those board meetings or those core group meetings and then back out again. So that personal relationship that you have with the head of finance and the head of HR and the chief exec and all of that is less important. So I think it gives that one step removed distance that the head of ESG wouldn't have. There's also some really interesting emerging evidence. I mean, there's a wealth of evidence around the value of diversity on boards and what happens if you have that human diversity, you know, in terms of protected characteristics on a board and the quality of the decisions the board will then make. But it seems to be emerging evidence seems to indicate that by having a nature represented in some mechanism on the board, that further improves the quality and it also further increases the likelihood of pro-environmental decisions being made by the board. But particularly interestingly is that the nature guardian doesn't have to have either a vote or even a voice to have that impact. So that you can have a silent nature guardian sitting in the boardroom, and their presence will have an impact on the decisions that are made.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think it was Helen from Make It Wild who has that practice on their board, where they have a sort of an empty chair that represents nature in the conversation. And that's enough to kind of hold people and hold that construct in mind during the decision-making process. What I've so appreciated about this conversation, Tom, is that you've introduced me and hopefully the listeners to two quite new ideas, this idea of natural flood management and the construct of nature guardians. But you describe both of them as restorative practices. So I wonder, first of all, what you meant by that. And secondly, if we were to see these practices adopted at scale, what would you envisage for, I know, the Welsh landscape in the next 5-10 years or whatever time frame feels helpful to consider?
So I do definitely see both of these as restorative practices, because I think both becoming more attuned to nature and nature's needs, they are both things that humans have done through millennia and through many cultures and civilizations. And they're both things that it feels like we in the developed Western world have just forgotten how to do over the last 100, 150 years. We've become much more distant from nature. And I think we live in much more of a shallow ecology type worldview now. It's not about going back to, oh, living like a caveman in a cave and shunning off all of the modern technology and the wonders of being able to switch a light on and having hot running water out of the tap. All of that stuff has brought us incredible health and well-being benefits, but there are some things that we've forgotten and that we've got too distant from. And there are some cultures around the world that still have some of that connection. Interestingly, you talk to some cultures and they find the concept of nature guardian so alien, because they are so see themselves as being humans being part of nature, that it's like, well, what are you doing? This is really disjointed. But I think where we've got to, we need some sort of restorative practice to bring people back to nature and for us to start paying more attention to the world around us and the needs of the world around us. The same with the water. If we just pause and think more holistically about what water does, how it moves, why it moves in that way, and if we want to do something slightly different with it, then what approaches might we be able to use to do that? Then quite often the answers come from themselves. You know, we do a natural flood management, an introduction to natural flood management training course. It's a one-day course. And a lot of it is just about getting people to think more holistically and look at the landscape around them from a slightly different lens. So I think that's what I mean by them being restorative practices. If we were to see this done on scale, I'm constantly having conversations with water companies. I'm trying to have conversations with insurance companies, protected landscapes teams, you know, the likes of NRW, some big, larger stakeholders, about how we start doing natural flood management at real scale. And I said early on, if we do 100 of these features, it's not going to stop someone's house from flooding downstream. But if everyone in the top end of a catchment does a couple of hundred of these features, cumulatively, they add up to something massive. And what we would see is a multiple benefit of those reduced flood peaks downstream, those reduced periods of low flow and drought, the ecological biodiversity habitat benefits, the nutrients being held up in the uplands and giving those really powerful green flushes of vegetation growth down the banks of the watercourse instead of massive algal blooms down in the main river. But we do need to shift this small-scale NFM to the point where there's millions of pounds a year being invested in it instead of the tens and hundreds of millions of pounds a year that we're currently investing in pouring concrete to manage water. There is a huge openness to this that wasn't really there a couple of years ago. So there are lots of conversations about this, but I don't see that we've had any success by doing 1,000 installations in the Upper Usk. I will see that we've had some level of, started to have some level of success when we've done 30,000 installations in the Upper Usk, because at that point, we're starting to chip away at it and make a difference. But it's going to need hundreds of thousands of installations. It's going to need hundreds, if not thousands, of people in Wales understanding what NFM is and learning the skills to do it and to read a watercourse and to understand where to install and where not to.
Well, if I was listening to that, I guess, pitch from the position of nature, and there was the choice between concrete and natural flood management, I know what I'd be opting for. So let's hope that those in the positions of power have a similar perspective on that offer, Tom.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sure they do. It is a mindset shift, and lots of the thinking around water management has come, understandably, from an engineering background with very clear, quantifiable outcomes. And so it does take a big about turn for a lot of people, which is not easy or comfortable. And it does require a little bit more, a little bit less risk aversion.
And Tom, just before we close out, and thank you from my side, thank you very much for your time and your knowledge. If people wanted to find out more about yourself, where can we direct them?
You can track me down on LinkedIn or our website, which I will ask you to put into the show notes. But we are nature-based CIC, Community Interest Company. We work across all of Wales on those twin areas, nature-based solutions, natural flood management and nature governance. And I'm always keen to pick up the conversation, and we've really positioned ourselves as being able to offer the resource that anybody needs. So if you just need a hand getting your ordinary watercourse consent, get in touch. We can help out with just that. If you've got an entire area of land that you know you need a load of NFM on, you don't know where to start, we can come in and do the entire piece for you or alongside with you. So yeah, we will just drop in and lend a hand. We just want to see more nature-based solutions being adopted all across Wales.
I actually want to start by picking up on one of Tom's last points around this idea of restorative practices. And I think what's really interesting is that with both natural flood management and nature guardianship, you're talking about a kind of a natural solution rather than a controlled one. So if you think about like water storage, obviously when you're building a concrete tank, you know exactly to the liter how much water is going to be stored, what its discharge rate is going to be, how quickly it's going to fill up depending on the rate of water. So that's a very like human need to control. You want a certain solution. And the contrast between that approach and natural flood management and I think nature guardianship is you're sitting with a lot more uncertainty. Nature isn't as predictable. You don't quite know what direction things are going to go in, and you're kind of working with that natural system. And similarly with nature guardianship, obviously you're talking about having a representative in a space, and you don't know quite how that's going to shift the direction of conversation or change the energy in the room or introduce difference, but it's sort of trusting in a process that feels intuitively right.
Yeah, to some people. And I think that's the challenge, isn't it? That's the kind of the skeptic in me is natural management. We've seen it work on the land. It definitely works. It definitely retains water back. The challenge that I think we touched on briefly, but the challenge I see is it has to be supported at a governmental level with recurring funding, significant funding every 3 years. The natural flood management that has been put in place gets replaced. That's logistically challenging, but feels like the right thing to do, much better than building a dam or weir or wherever it ends up being to hold it back. And then with the nature guardianship, as Tom says, at the moment, it's all nature-leaning organisations. And it helps them if you've got a product that is nature-leaning to say they've got nature on the board. Not only does it help them, gives them a true north, which is super important, but also helps them in branding and a bunch of other stuff. The key will be for Tom and anyone else looking to do this is how do we get the next step removed from nature organizations to start thinking about that as an importance, and how do we get them to do the uptick and seeing how having nature on the board changes their perspective. I'm really, really excited for that. I don't think it's going to be very easy, but if you achieve that, I think there's some really exciting effects that having nature on the board will have for organizations.
And I know Tom has been in conversations with some fairly large insurance companies and water companies, which is really exciting because that's the scale we need to address some of these problems. Maybe he could go with both offers, and perhaps we can be scaling up both natural flood management, and maybe they too will be having nature guardians on their boards within the next 3 to 5 years. That would be a really exciting aim to work towards.
It sounds like I'm a negative Nelly here, and it isn't that. I'm so behind Tom and his passion, and he's far smarter than I am in terms of his experience and knowledge in this space. So I'm really not challenging his perspective on this. But the challenge with nature guardianship is like, what would nature think? It requires everyone who's going to sit on that role is going to have a different perspective. Tom's approach is sit back and say, well, I don't know, but let's talk about it. But I can imagine someone else sitting on there going, saying, I'm really highly qualified. I actually think I know what nature would say here at this point. And then if you have other approach, which is sit back and talk it through, it requires people on the board to be nature savvy, which again is quite a challenge. You've got to kind of upskill them up to a point to understand basically what nature is, which, you know, as we discussed us 3 years ago, we were not particularly we weren't nature connected. We didn't have that nature knowledge. So if you'd asked us what would nature think, we'd probably say what we said 3 years ago and what we say today would be two separate things. So, but I think it's important to know, and Tom would say this himself, is it's not as simple as just putting nature on the board and it's going to solve problems.
No, absolutely. And I think there are comparisons. I think Tom was talking about natural flood management as this gateway drug for regenerative
agriculture. Well, he wasn't saying that.
I think it was his phrase.
I think he was saying he was misquoted, maybe, is what he was saying. Oh.
Whoever's phrase it was, I'm going to take it and spin it now into, you know, is nature guardianship the gateway drug into holding nature more as a entity in our decision making? You know, what are the next steps? Giving nature legal rights. There are places in the world where rivers have rights and they are recognized as a legal body. Is it about bringing nature connection into these discussions? I know, for example, in the US partnership, they're experimenting at the moment with using some nature connection practices to start off their meetings, so that not only have you just got one person embodying nature in the room, but actually every single person has set an intention for the conversation by starting off the discussion with their feet in the river and really connecting to that space.
Are you trying to upsell our nature connection activities here to Tom, his board members, to get them out? And that's embarrassing, Chloe. I can't believe that's just so flagrantly trying to promote what we're doing here.
I mean, absolutely, that is not my intention. We're not even part of the ask catchment here. We're the my catchment. So, but, you know, I do think there is something about how can we introduce that sense or felt sense of nature, not just the cognitive sense of nature, into these key decision-making forums.
Mm. And just two final things to finish off the podcast. First of all, if you are continuing to enjoy and appreciate the work that we're putting together for the Wilder podcast, if you have the opportunity, please do feel free, if you don't mind, stop what you're doing and quickly go on to whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on and leave us a quick review, a star rating, and move us on. It can be as short or as long as you feel you've got the time for, but it makes a big difference for the podcast and moving forward. And finally, just think about what I said about the fact that the natural flood management had to be replaced every 3 years. Actually, I seem to remember Tom mentioning it depends what kind of wood you use. It depends on the size of the wood you put in the water course. So clearly there will be some installations that will last for 100, 150 years, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm talking about the kind of the smaller, but my point still stands. Some of them will require being replaced.
Well done, Tom. Always good to offer some clarification on key points.
I knew you could hear Tom in the back of my head just screaming at me there.
And the next episode, we're really going to try to aim for 2 weeks because we've got no excuses. The hub is open. We are receiving guests. We look forward to welcoming you here.
Absolutely no excuses.